Coming up on Boston Public Radio with just 19 hours till the polls open, we'll start with politics. Former Republican Treasurer Joe Malone and Globe columnist Joan Vernocchi on what if you throw a U.S. Senate election and no one comes. And then, first Tim Murray left the number two state job halfway through. Now the Celtics coach Doc Rivers is leaving town. Does anyone honor their commitments anymore? Should they? And speaking of Rivers, Marjorie.
That's right. The Reverend Gene Rivers joins us for open mic at 1 p.m. to talk about Aaron Hernandez's hysteria in North Attleboro versus zero hysteria about shootings in inner city Boston. And did you know? Boston tortures thousands of tourists every year by inviting them here to see the Freedom Trail. Surprise, surprise, not a bathroom in sight. We detail that delicate problem and more up next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Eakin. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you. Happy summer, Marjorie.
Thank you
it's
very
pretty
much.
Good, isn't
it? It's wonderful.
Okay, so polls open in about 19 hours in a Senate race, which seems to have generated less interest than the comings and goings of Aaron Hernandez. Here to discuss Gomez versus Markey, immigration reform, and maybe even Hernandez himself, or former Massachusetts Republican treasurer. He's now a partner at Plymouth Rock Financial. Hey, Joe Malone.
Hey,
how are
Jim.
You?
Hey, I'm doing great. Hi, Marge.
Good
and
to
wonderful to be here. My first, by the way, visit to you and your new digs
new
here.
Digs.
Boy,
if you do well, there might be another visit.
Moved
you never
on
know.
Up. I'll tell you
that's
what.
How we look at it. And Joan Vernocchi, who is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Joan Vernocchi.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hi, you guys. Thank you very much for coming in. So I think it's been the most overwritten cliche of this whole Gomez-Markey race. Everybody's bored. Everybody's bored. Nobody cares. Several theories. Frank Phillips had in the Globe this morning that he thought it was, or maybe it was yesterday morning, that he thought it was just special election, you know, overload. You know, I wrote yesterday that I thought it was because they're both kind of not very inspiring candidates. Galvin thinks it's because that's the Secretary of State, Bill Galvin, who thinks it's because it's, you know, Whitey Bulger, Bruins. Is that it? Is that why nobody cares? One of the three, all the above? Joan Vernocchi, start with you. Why does nobody care?
You got to give me the hard one right off the bat. Why doesn't anyone care? Well, I think we went through a fairly fast and furious election season last time, you know, in November. Obama, Elizabeth Warren versus Scott Brown. And there is such a thing as political overload. I find myself caring a little bit less about the politics of the moment, not watching every cable TV show and not being as keyed into it. And it's my job to do it. So
yeah.
You can
I noticed
only imagine.
You weren't watching me the other night. I actually noticed that, Joan. I meant to speak to you about that off the air. You know, when I hear that, I know it's true, and I sort of feel the same way, Joe Malone. But as someone who has run for elective office statewide, isn't it pathetic? I mean, this whole election fatigue thing, special election fatigue. I mean, grow up, essentially. I mean, isn't that the right answer?
Well, if the premise is that everybody's tired, well, then it's the campaigns, the respective
Thank
campaigns'
you,
job
yes.
to break through that fatigue.
And, have
and,
they?
And they haven't, no. I honestly, I've said from early on, in the case of Gomez, he's about a B candidate, and his campaign is an F campaign. Very, very poorly.
Why is it an F campaign?
Because you need to add flesh to the bones of who a candidate is. And, you know, sometimes it's a little story you tell about, you know, one of your children and as a way of manifesting, you know, why you stand in a certain place issue-wise. Or sometimes it's a case of, you know, going back to your childhood and talking about something there. I've heard nothing of that.
How about the Navy SEAL thing? That's
you know,
a personal part of it.
That becomes
sort of the, you know, opportunistic, I'm going to repeat this, to the point where you take what's a plus and it becomes sort of a caricature of his campaign.
I agree, but plus, the Navy SEAL thing in his case was almost more of a mystery because if you asked him for details about what he actually did, he said, and this may be absolutely true, that it's kind of a code of honor that they don't talk about their exploits. So, okay.
Do you know, I asked him on TV once, I think it was on TV,
what he thought. Did he give you an exploit?
No, I asked him what he thought of Zero Dark 30. And he actually said he didn't want to comment on it because there was this whole Navy SEAL thing. Even commenting on the movie.
Well, I'm not. You know, I think you raised a great point, Joe Malone, because you don't know anything about the guy. Mm. He's got four kids. You know, does anybody play soccer?
Right,
does anybody?
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, we haven't seen the At Home with Gabriel Gomez. You haven't seen that famous house that you got the different facade on.
Right.
Got the big tax break on.
Last week they released a web ad, which I'm probably the only person who actually looked at, in which he had his four kids. And they were all very cute and adorable and sort of rolling their eyes about something or other. And it humanized them. And I thought, why did they wait for 3 days before the election? And why didn't somebody kick in enough money so he could have made that into a real ad instead of the dirty Ed Markey ads that they just kept on running over and over again?
Which are too much. I don't think you want to be calling it a dirty campaign all the time and pond scum. That was like a real a low moment. But, you know, when you talk about his handlers, in the last debate, we were all making a joke here because we had a little analysis post-debate. That Gomez said at least 20, if not more times, Ed Markey's a stale old loaf who's been in Congress for 37 years. I'm wondering, did Gomez think it was appropriate to keep saying 37 years 25 times, or did his handlers think it?
One of his handlers used to work for Joe Malone, by the way, before he went to the Boston Herald, before he
Eric
went to Mitt Romney, Eric Furniture.
Well, Eric Furniture is a very smart guy.
By the way, as I understand it, Eric is working on the super PAC on behalf of, so they can't talk, one can't talk to the other. But I honestly, I really don't even know much about the inner workings of this campaign, but going to your point about the 37, you know, times, it becomes the consultant mentality sitting around a table saying, oh, look at the data says here that people aren't really happy with the fact that Markey's been there that long. So mention it 100 times in the debate. Well, you know, there's nuance to everything.
Yeah, exactly.
And they missed that point.
Are you voting for him, Jim Malone?
You know what? I will vote for him. But a part of my reason for voting for him is, again, because I think he is a potentially, in the future, a good candidate who, you know, has a
Let
good
me stop
story
you right
to
there.
Tell.
More than once on this show, he has been described as a Joe Malone, and in this regard, not in terms of your skill or in politics, you ran against Ted Kennedy, you got crushed, but most people thought you ran a totally respectable race, and lo and behold, then you ran for statewide office, you were elected treasurer. Is Gomez Joe Malone part two in that regard,
Well,
you
know, it's interesting, by the way, going back to the Coakley race, I was hearing the same thing about Scott Brown, and lightning struck that it didn't turn out that that was a dry run for him. In fact, he won. In the case of Gomez, I think you'll see him run again, and I think this is kind of laying the foundation for a future run. But, again, I go back to his campaign team. He better find a new team next time he
didn't
runs.
Run,
this was pathetic.
He didn't run as good a campaign as Joe Malone
No,
did.
He did not.
That's the problem. I mean, Joe Malone was able to go from running against Ted Kennedy and then run for state treasurer because he laid the foundation for a future run. I think it's going to be a lot. I'm sure maybe Gomez will run again, but he's going to have to start. I agree with you. He will have to start building a new foundation.
By the way, just a side note on that, you know, which is just a way in which to validate it. The polls that were then taken, me running against Bob Crane, I had an 18-point lead over him, which then 27-year veteran of the Treasury, Crane says, I'm going to, you know, retire. So we will know a lot about Gomez coming out of this campaign in terms of what the aftertaste is if, in fact, he doesn't win.
But
Can
I just go quickly back to the idea of when Scott Brown ran, and that's become, you know, the moment, the iconic moment of somebody beating a Democrat. The ads, everything about it was so much more creative and imaginative than we're seeing now. And if the same people are running Gomez, I mean, Gomez, the old line is he should be suing them for political malpractice.
Right.
He started out, Brown started out with that ad of JFK morphing into Scott Brown. Then he had the famous Brown in the truck.
Right.
Then he had Brown, I think, in his kitchen just talking to people. He seemed like a real person.
In front of his refrigerator.
We remember those.
Right.
We haven't seen
by
any
the way,
of
and
that.
And the daughter was involved in one ad, maybe both of them. They even had the online video that they ran, which was just him in a snowball fight with his daughter, you know, and just a way to say, here's a real person that transcends a Republican label that the opponent is trying to put on him.
That's the voice of Joe Malone, former Republican treasurer of Massachusetts. The other voice belongs to Joan Vernocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe.
You know, the thing about Gomez is you look at him on paper and everything looks perfect. You know, he's Latino, you know, he's got the great backstory. Story, the Harvard Business School, the Advent International.
Advent International.
Yeah, that you haven't been happy, Jim Browdy, that he hasn't revealed enough information about that. And, of course, the Navy SEAL landing the planes. It's all there, but it just shows, to me, in politics. I mean, you weren't a Navy SEAL, Joe Malone, but everybody kind of liked you and paid attention to you. And you were – people liked you, and people like Scott Brown. There's not that thing. There's not that connection with
Gomez. Yeah, but we got to make this fair. You wrote a piece yesterday in which while we spent 10 minutes saying that Gomez can't quite cut it, you wrote a piece yesterday essentially suggesting his opponent can't quite cut it either.
Well, he's a very boring guy, too. I mean, I always say he looks like a character out of Downton Abbey. You know, he's got that weird hairdo going on. This is Ed Markey, of course, he's been there for 37 years. But I was at a rally in Cambridge, Jim, your hometown, where people were apologizing for handing out plastic water bottles because they were made of plastic and urging everyone to recycle. It was like a caricature. But in any case, the person that had all the star power at that event was Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, not Ed Markey. Everybody's running up to her for the autograph. She was holding court. And he kind of buzzed in and he kind of buzzed out and he gave his little staccato speech. But Ed Markey is much more in tune with the politics of Massachusetts.
That's right. I mean, this is really the sadness of it from the Republican point of view. Nobody really wants to vote for Ed Markey. People are going to have to vote for Ed Markey on the issues, because of the issues, because Gomez.
Assault weapons bans.
Right.
Well, speaking of, I've asked virtually every Republican we've spoken to, and I can ask you too, Joan Bernanke, whatever your political affiliation is. I can't make the case that even if Gabriel Gomez was the second coming of, I don't know, the best candidate ever, how in Massachusetts do you win a statewide election when you're pro-life, even if you say you're not going to mess with Roe v. Wade and you're against an assault weapons ban? I mean, how do you ever get over those two things in liberal Massachusetts? I can't construct a campaign where you do.
I mean, the pro-life issue put aside for 1 second, just to focus on the background checks, you know, when assault weapons ban. I mean, on that one, I was telling Joan off the air, what happens in a primary, Republican primary, the gun owners are such a huge piece of the primary puzzle that, man, everybody wants to go to the right on those issues. And then they get into the final, and it makes a real problem for them in terms of the overall electorate of Massachusetts.
Do you think Gomez essentially got locked into this no ban on high-capacity magazines, weapons ban because he had to win a primary?
I think the Romney people spent 8 years trying to appeal to Republicans across the nation, and they've forgotten what a Massachusetts voter is all about. And you see it a million different ways. The night of his primary, the ad that they run from that primary victory speech looks like something out of Ralph Lauren. You know, all these very well-dressed white people, and this guy is supposed to be the guy appealing to this Hispanic vote. I mean, I would have put him in a VFW hall in Lynn or in Quincy or something and say to the people of this state, I'm a different Republican. I'm someone who wants to bring education to every walk of life because that's where opportunity is. That's what happened for me. Instead, they ran a Romney-esque campaign.
You know, before we get to you, Joan, and this can you be pro-life and anti an assault weapons ban, at the final debate the other night, Ed Markey twice said, what does a civilian need to be able to fire 100 rounds in 2 minutes? Gomez never directly answered. He was asked the question again on WCVB's On the Record this weekend with Janet Wu and Ed Harding. They were talking about guns. Here's Gomez first, then Janet Wu, then Gomez again. Listen up.
I think a law-abiding citizen should be able to buy his weapon.
To do what?
To go use his weapon for fun that he wants to do, go to a shooting range and what they do.
Okay, Joan Bernanke, whether you want to comment on that or not, how about my thesis? You can't be pro-life and anti-assault weapons ban, no matter how good a candidate you are, and expect to win an election in Massachusetts. You buy it?
I do buy it. I think when you're talking about a candidate that Massachusetts voters are thinking about sending down to Washington, D.C., it's a really, really tough sell. I think maybe Republicans in Massachusetts could have a easier time of it, but still a difficult time running for statewide office like governor, where the social issues play in but are not your opponent is not going to say he's a vote for Mitch McConnell when he goes to D.C. Once that's around their neck, it's really, really hard, I think, to get people to think of anything but that.
Let's assume Gomez had not made the comment he made at the end of, I guess, the Springfield debate, was it, about the no litmus test. If a person is qualified for the Supreme Court and happens to be pro-life, he would cast a Senate vote for him. If he had just said this, which is where I thought he was going earlier in the campaign, I'm Ted Kennedy. I'm Mario Cuomo.
Yeah.
I am Jesse Jackson. I am Joe Biden. I am personally opposed to abortion, but I will never do anything to interfere.
Would have been.
There you could get over, could you not?
Joe Malone and I settled this in the room before we came on. We said the same thing. If he just said, I would, Ed, where Ed Markey was 37 years ago, if he said any of that, but he didn't. Maybe part of it is, I think a large part of it is, his total political inexperience. He's not comfortable talking about issues. He's not comfortable phrasing things in a way that make people feel, okay, that's his personal belief. What's he going to do if I vote for him?
Okay, one last thing before we take a break. This is for both of you. When we call you Wednesday at noon, when Gomez has been elected the senator from Massachusetts, what are you going to say, Joe Malone? Great campaign,
well, you
huh?
know, hey, good for him if he does. You know, believe me, I would be very, very happy. But right now, one poll's got him down 20, another one's got him down 8, another one's got him down 10. I think it's probably 8, 9,
You're
10.
You're not going to take the call, Joe Vinocchio.
No, I'll take the call. I'll just say that a lot of Democrats stayed home and the Republicans got their vote such as it is out. It's
fair
all
enough.
About who
and
shows
the way, though,
up tomorrow.
And I didn't want this to go by without saying, in the case of Ed Markey, though, he is someone who has been there too long. He's a big government guy. You're sending a homogeneous group of individuals down to Washington to all walk lockstep. It's a sad commentary that the Republican Party in Massachusetts now is relegated to 11% of the electorate.
Okay, we are talking politics with Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinocchi and former Republican Treasurer Joe Malone. That conversation is going to continue on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio right after this.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan, joining us, as they were a couple of minutes ago. Yet again, Joan Vinocchi is a great columnist for the Boston Globe. Joe Malone is the former Republican state treasurer of Massachusetts. He's a partner at Plymouth Rock Financial. You know, I made a joke, which was really not very funny, Joe Malone, at the top, saying the public in Massachusetts is probably more interested in what's going on with Aaron Hernandez, you know, who's allegedly may have some involvement in the murder of this guy, Odin Lloyd, from a semi-professional football team from Dorchester than they are in this election. But do you, as a consumer of news, find it, let me put it this way, odd, the amount of attention that has been focused on Hernandez, the stationing of reporters outside his house, the OJ-like Bronco chase scenes from helicopters of his, what did he go to, Foxborough Stadium to Gillette Stadium into the gas station?
Gas station, that was my favorite part.
In a world where Lindsay Lohan and all these other Hollywood types are right up there on the nightly news with war and peace and the economy and so forth, no, it doesn't surprise me. And I think this is one of those things, particularly where the Patriots have put themselves up on a pedestal and we're only going to draft character players and so forth. You have this side story now that will continue to have legs, which is, you know, do you cut the guy? Do you send him packing?
Well, what do you think about it? I mean, you were, for those that don't know, you were a big football player at Harvard, right? Didn't you
You're
play
being
at Harvard?
Kind, but
well,
at
you
Harvard.
Were a football player
yeah,
at Harvard.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously you know a lot about football. I mean, does this sort of put the lie to the whole Patriots notion that we only do the moral high road kinds of players? We don't want those other players, no matter how good they
well,
are.
Well, you remember there was a Patriot that was drafted, or a player that was drafted, that Myra
Christian Peter from Nebraska
his rap sheet and said, we don't want this guy. This was, you know, not good for the community. And she's probably turning over in her grave right now, because it's not only Hernandez, it's a number of other people where when they show real character challenges, they drop from first-round pick down to fourth round or fifth round, and in the case of Hernandez, that's what occurred. Then they become a bargain, and you bring them on the team, and you say, well, hopefully we can reform this guy. And obviously, and the more that comes out about this Hernandez, the worse it looks.
Now, you're the former NFL columnist for the Globe, as we know, many years ago, Joan Vinocchi. When you're watching the two, when you're watching television and seeing the wall-to-wall Hernandez, what kind of emotional reaction do you have to that, Joan?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking. Of course, I didn't play football at Harvard or anything. But, okay, I'm going to sound, I don't, maybe not cynical, but now we know what it takes to get people to focus on the death of a black man from Dorchester.
That's exactly right.
If the same individual had, you know, died in a fusillade in some street in Dorchester, The media would not be staking it out. We wouldn't know the details about his life that we know now. And I guess I just think it's depressing that this is what it takes to get people to focus on death, that this football player has not yet been charged with anything. I guess he sounds like he was involved.
In fact, John, there was a triple homicide Friday night, Saturday morning at Interville Street.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's come and gone in terms of newsworthiness.
And a shooting last week with a four-year-old kid in the back of the car while the shooting went on. And Brianna Bigby was killed before that, a woman, 23-year-old woman, that was doing nothing wrong except sitting in the car with a guy who was targeted. I mean, it is kind of crazy what's going on.
I don't really get the wall-to-wall coverage. I understand the allure of celebrities. I didn't think a football player – it's not Tom Brady. I mean, it's obviously he was an important player. I kind of feel, I'd say, bad about a guy who's been given a second chance, signed a $36 million contract, had every opportunity to sort of cash in on doing a good job on the football field, and it seems like he wasn't able to cut loose the old ties. And I think it's a sad and depressing story.
You know, well, one of the things Marjorie and I were talking – you're going to mention what we were talking about before.
I was talking about babysitting, babysitting
thing.
Well, you know, it's ridiculous in some ways, but in some ways it's not. I think if you are going to recruit these highly talented kids from very troubled pasts, certainly in college, and they don't even do this in college, they need a babysitter until they get out of there. And maybe in professional sports, I mean, they're not that old. What are they, 22, 23, some of these guys that come in there? They're obviously adult men, but they almost need babysitting.
But, you know, when you talk about a babysitter, oftentimes their agent plays that role, or they have a management team that plays that role.
Yeah.
So here's a guy who's making $8 million a year. And that management team really should be the one saying, hey, don't blow this. Don't show up late for practice. Don't get in with a bad group of people who are going to destroy your reputation or maybe worse. And somewhere along the line, that player then rebels from the so-called babysitter.
Yeah. So you think it goes on already.
Or the babysitter that starts to become an enabler because they don't want to be fired as a
these
babysitter.
People can't say no to these. You know,
they
I hate
can,
to keep
right.
hearkening to your sports background, but we know what you did. Your kid. What'd your kid do?
Yeah, so he went off as a walk-on at Kentucky and then became,
And they
so
won the national championship that year.
And he knows these kids from his team who all end up in the NBA. And
so how are they taken care of? Who's the coach there?
Calipari.
Right, who was I don't want to put you on the spot.
He
had a few problems at UMass.
He didn't. A player of his took something of value.
Okay,
you know,
but every place he goes is the same deal. But the question is, you don't have to comment on that, Joe Malone. But did they take care of these stars? Like, what is it, Anthony Davis was the number one draft and are they monitor or these kids who become millionaires overnight from Kentucky, are they taken care of? Are they looked after?
Not only do they look after them while they're in school, but they're teaching them lessons such as, you know, you need to give something back and you have to be conscious of the fact whether you like it or not, there are a lot of eyes on you, many of them young people. I mean, they drive that into their minds. In the case of Hernandez, again, you know, he was one of these people, you know, seems like anyway, that just didn't want to listen to any good advice. And also, too, with Kentucky, they are able to draft or rather recruit kids who are not only good athletes but good kids. It's the other programs that maybe are in the middle of the pack that say, hey, we're going to take a chance with this kid. So,
you know, Joe Malone, we talked about this before, you and I, because there was a kid from my hometown. I knew his family very well, Chris Heron, who went to the Celtics. And
his father was a state rep.
Yes, his father was a state rep. And same thing. He would have been way up in the NBA draft, but he got down because he had drug problems.
Yeah.
But in that great HBO movie, which was done about him called Unguarded, he talked about the fact that when he was at Tarkanian was the coach, a team out west somewhere in college. Yes, that they babysat him 24/7 to make sure he would not go back to using drugs. Now, you could say that's a little bit ridiculous, but the kid said himself he had the best season of his whole life, and then what happens, he comes back to the Celtics, he's 50 miles from Fall River, and he's back.
In that vein, Kentucky basketball, from the time you get there in September till about the end of the NCAAs, which is mid-April, you have a 10:30 curfew during the week, 11:30 during the weekend. Imagine for a college kid.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that with a pro athlete.
No, you don't. But, I mean, the point is, at that stage, hopefully they're being taught some life skills.
Right.
You know?
I think that the other message from this is that the Patriot way has been kind of exposed as a myth of branding. The incident that you mentioned from Christian Peter, which is a player that Myra Kraft interceded on and said, no, we don't want him playing for us. That was in 1996, a really long time ago. I think her influence waned over the years, and of course now she's, you know, sadly is not there. And Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft are making decisions that they want to make in the interest of what they think is establishing a winning team. But they haven't won a Super Bowl in, what, 7 years?
Or more, is it? Well, whatever it is. Yeah, but that voice, by the way, is Joan Vinacci. She's a columnist for The Globe, and Joe Malone, the other guy there, is the Harvard football player.
So it hasn't really worked
out. State treasurer
of
Massachusetts.
It hasn't been a winning formula.
Well, right. Can we speak of winning
formula? Mr. Kraft's decisions making lately has been
okay, let's leave it right there, Marjorie. I know where you're going. Can we talk about another decision, which I would argue matters a little bit more than drafting? There's a huge and important vote in the United States Senate today on border security. Theoretically, this thing is going to pass. When it passes, they're going to add 20,000 border security guards. It's almost shoulder to shoulder border security from California to wherever, Texas or something like that. The theory being that's going to make enough conservative Republicans, or at least moderate to conservative Republicans, happy in the Senate that there might be 70 votes for immigration reform. And then Joe Malone, it goes to the House, where John Boehner said, not only am I not going to bring up the Senate bill, I'm not going to bring up anything unless a majority, not of the House, a majority of Republicans agree to this. If the Tea Party / very conservative Republicans in the House kill immigration reform, which is at least possible, what are the consequences, if any, for the national GOP?
Well, of course, when the last election occurred and the Republicans got less than 30% of the Hispanic vote,
71-29.
At that point, every Republican was in agreement that, you know, you can't continue going down this path. But now you fast forward about 6 months, and enough Republicans in the House appear to be moving back into that same position, and it'll hurt the Republicans badly. Not to mention, I think most incumbents will be hurt. Once again, you have Congress with, what, 11% or 10% approval rate? It's as if they can't get anything done. I think the Republicans, sadly, will be blamed for it.
Now, if they were speaking candidly in the House, though, what they'd say, Joan, is Republicans may be blamed for it, but because we have gerrymandered brilliantly, Republicans and Democrats back home, we have no problem getting reelected, so it's not going to have any impact on Congress at all. They're right, sadly, are they not?
I think that they are, and whether or not it passes, I mean, I'll believe it when something actually passes. And I also kind of doubt that it's really immigration reform.
Why? Why do you say that?
Well, I don't know.
You think it's border security reform?
And I don't even think it'll be that. I doubt that they'll really deliver on that, what they're saying they will. I mean, they're having budget issues right now with enough people on the border.
You know what happened the other day that I think may turn – I don't know if we discussed this with John King last week.
What?
If we won't, we will tomorrow. I think we did. Is you and I think put it over the edge is not so much this border security thing. Everything is so much about dollars and cents. When the nonpartisan, you always have to say that, Congressional Budget Office said $1 trillion in savings if the Senate bill passes over the next 2 decades. Isn't that all a lot of these people care about is bottom line? And the bottom line appears to be a good one, Joan.
I've become skeptical about even the CBO numbers.
Yeah.
Oof. Yeah, well, and again, back to the overall legislation, this has been one that conservative talk show hosts have just been banging away at now for, what, how many, 5, 6, 7, 8 years? And everybody is looking for cover on the Republican side. And it's kind of sad that it's gotten to that point because there really are some basics that need to be, you know, the boxes need to be checked off. And if you check off those boxes,
well,
you should be able to come up with legislation. But
the biggest thing to me when you read story after story after story about some kid that comes here who's coming from another country, goes to, you know, MIT and is some super genius, but he can't stay here and start his equivalent of Google because his paperwork is run out. He has to go home. That kid, was it India, the guy from MIT that went back and started that great company? He could have stayed here and started the great company.
So that's a good point. You know, you hear time and time again, we don't have enough engineers in this country. And the immigration system of this country, much like the IRS, I would attest, is so screwed up that you can't end up getting through paperwork and red tape quickly enough to stay here.
Yeah,
and they
ridiculous.
Can add tremendous value.
That's
so
part of
can I ask you a serious question? You're going to think it's a joke. If you were a young kid, Joe Malone, all over again, you were 18 years old, you're about to register to vote for the first time, would you register as an independent or a Republican?
You know what? It's hard to say that.
Republican.
Let me put it this way. I find myself thinking of the Republican Party less in the sense of us and more of the sense of them. You know, when I'm looking at the Republicans, I'm saying, why don't they do things differently? And there are a lot of self-inflicted wounds that seem to be never ending.
I think it might be a good time to run as an independent in Massachusetts, because it may be the only way to avoid all of the baggage and the, you know, the albatross of social issues and avoid the thing. Well, when you get down there, you'll be in vote for Mitch McConnell. If you're an independent, you won't be.
And by who's the way, last series in other parts of New England as well, where an independent is winning.
We got to run, but who's the last major independent to run for anything in Massachusetts? Was there one? I agree with you completely, but then I say to myself, I'm talking to Joan, then I say to myself, well, who was the last?
Cahill.
Okay, Hill, of course.
But keep in mind, he's coming from on one day he's a Democrat, okay, the next day he's an independent, which is a little different, but still
I'm a little
an
ahead of my time, but I think it would be a good moment.
Joan Malone, Joan Vinaki, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Joan Vinaki is, of course, a Boston Globe columnist and Treasurer Joe Malone, former Treasurer Joe Malone, is a Republican, and we see him on TV all the time on Fox News in the morning, do we not?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us. Okay, you guys, is it time for Doc Rivers to turn into Celtic pride for the L.A. Clippers? Jim is beside himself over this. We'll ask you, is it good for the Celtics, or is backing out his commitment to Boston and his team a terrible, dastardly thing, as Jim thinks? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. First, it was Tim Murray. Remember him? Former lieutenant governor, quit his job halfway through his term for a $75,000 pay hike to become head of the, I think it's called the Greater Worcester Chamber of Commerce. Now, it's Doc Rivers. He wanted out of his five-year deal with the Celtics, just signed 2 years ago, apparently because he doesn't want to rebuild, so he's going to the Los Angeles Clippers. I think there's similar situations. In fact, sadly, the public probably cares more about a coach than the commitment of a lieutenant governor. Here's our question for you at 877-301-8970. I hate to be old school, but if you make a commitment, shouldn't you honor it? I say yes. Apparently, many people think this is much ado about not much. We'll start with lieutenant governor. Said he wanted to serve 4 more years, leaves in 2. Doc Rivers, who is beloved in this community, signed a 5-year contract for $7 million a year, and then he says he wants out and he's going to Los Angeles. I am troubled by, I love him. I think he's terrific. He's a great role model. I don't think this is great role modeling. I just don't like this new thing. I think it's new, where people make a commitment and then they decide, I've had enough. I'm leaving.
Well, you know, I studied the normally vicious comments on the stories about Doc Rivers in this morning's Herald and this morning's Globe.
They love him.
They love him.
I know.
They're wishing him well in Los Angeles. They're sad to see him go, but they understand he doesn't want to do a rebuilding kind of deal. They love him. So no one seems to be upset about this, as you are, Jim. And as I said to you before, when you had this obsession with Timothy Murray, the former lieutenant governor of the Commonwealth. You know, should Brian Williams suddenly have an accident and the big call comes in from, like, where's he on, NBC?
NBC. I don't think you get much higher than being
CBS.
The chief anchor on NBC.
Yeah. Okay. You know what I'm saying? You might say to yourself, well, things are great at
NBC. Honor the commitment.
Yeah.
By the way,
the
purpose of this discussion at 877-301-8970 is not about, at least in my mind, I don't really want to talk about Doc Rivers that much, nor Tim Murray. I want to talk about the notion, you make a deal, you honor the deal. Period. Listen to, here are two Doc Rivers. Here's Doc Rivers in May of 2011. This is a post-game press conference after the Celtics ended their playoff season. They lost to the Miami Heat. Here's what he has to say.
You know, I'm a Celtic, and I love our guys. And I want to win again here. I do. And I'm competitive as hell. I have a competitive group. And so we'll see. But I can tell you that's where I'm at today. Tomorrow I may change my mind, but that's where I'm at today.
No, but wait a second.
Exactly.
Marjorie, before you, no,
tomorrow
excuse me.
I may change my mind. Tomorrow came, he's changed
excuse
his
me.
Mind.
You know what happened a couple of months later?
What's that, Jim?
He signed a 5-year contract. And here's what was asked at the press conference after that. Some reporters said, well, isn't the 5-year deal, isn't it inevitable that you're going to be overseeing or you're going to be coaching a rebuilding team? You're looking forward to that. Here's Doc Rivers after that earlier comment. I don't think anyone's looking forward to that, but I'm willing to do it. I had a group that's been very loyal to me. I think it would have been very easy for me to just run and go somewhere else and chase something else. Here's the kicker. It would have been easier to do it that way. I just don't think it's the right thing to do. Coaches talk about loyalty and team all the time. I just thought it was time to show it. That was then. This is now. And again, if you want to talk about Doc Rivers, it's fine. I'm a great admirer of the guy. I don't know him, but I'm a great admirer of him. I just don't like, you make a commitment to somebody, you honor it. If you don't feel you can honor it, then don't make it. Don't say I'm going to serve 4 years as lieutenant governor. Don't say I'm going to be your coach for 5 years and then go to the boss and say, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go to California.
I don't know. I just don't see that same kind of loyalty in these teams at all. And I am no way a sports expert, but I just know from watching them.
It's not just about sports.
Do you see players up and go? I mean, look at the Red Sox. People are always leaving to go to the Yankees. Maybe not so much.
No,
anymore.
When their contracts are up, yeah, that's when they go. His contract's not up.
Because he negotiated a deal to leave. A lot of these times they can't do that because their lawyers or the legalities prevent it.
Well, Tim Murray, quote, negotiated a deal to leave too.
Jim, nobody
you
cares.
You can't do this.
Nobody cares.
Nobody does
about
care
Tim
except
Murray,
me.
Except for you.
And nobody cares about Doc Rivers thing except me. I am an old school kind of guy.
What happened
you make a commitment,
to Tim
you honor
Murray,
it.
He knew after his 108 mile per hour car crash in the middle of the night when he was supposedly getting a cup of coffee or looking at storm damage, whatever he said he was doing, or trying to buy a Boston Herald, that ridiculous story and his ties with a guy who,
Michael McLaughlin,
who has done bad things over at the Chelsea Housing Authority, he knew his career was over. He gets a chance to get a $200,000 a year job up at the Worcester Chamber of Commerce. That's where he's from. That's where everybody loves him. That's where he doesn't have to drive an hour every day to get to Boston.
You know, my
I think
position
he saw
is...
his political future as not existing
fine.
Anymore.
And so the answer is you complete your term and then go to Worcester. And if you're Doc Rivers, you complete your 5 years and then you go your
well,
you want.
Well, Paul Salucci, everybody loves, and he just died much too young, and he was a terrific guy. I didn't hear you complaining about Paul Salucci.
As a matter of fact, I complained vociferously because the answer is it's even worse when you're the top guy, as Doc Rivers is, as Paul Salucci, and Bill Weld. I'm a huge fan of Bill Weld's. Bill Weld shouldn't have left when he left because he was on this quixotic effort to become ambassador to Mexico. You make a commitment, you honor it. 877-301-8970. I don't know how, but you're going to live to regret this. I don't know how, but I know it's. Let's go to Thomas here in Dartmouth. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Thomas.
Hi, how are you doing?
Excellent.
Well, you know, I just think there's a little more to the story with the Doc Rivers situation.
What's that?
To agree with you, Jim. You know, the subplot is the Rajon Rondo conflict. I read reports today that they said that Rondo and Doc actually came to blows in a team meeting. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. There were similar accusations around Ray Allen leaving.
Yep.
So I think, you know, with Doc's situation, the environment might have been so toxic that it might have justified him leaving. I'm a little on the fence about it, but I do think there's a little more to the story than him just going to greener
pastures. But let's assume there is. The notion, Doc Rivers, I've literally met him for 2 seconds once. I don't know anything about him except he seems to be a really smart guy. If you're a really smart guy, you know there are going to be tensions when you're managing wealthy men, which is essentially what you do. You have 12 millionaires, or most of them are millionaires. The fact that he got an argument with a player, even a star player like Rajon Rondo, them's the breaks. That's you made a commitment to be here. So even if there are reasons for him to be disappointed, it doesn't cut it for me. But Thomas, thank you for the update. We appreciate that.
No one seems to care about this but you, Jim. Let me just repeat.
Well,
this.
No one
Our
seems
numbers
to
are 877-301-8970. Let's see if where are we going to? We're going to Lisa from Quincy. Let's see if she cares.
I don't care.
Oh, good.
No, but with the Doc Rivers situation, coaches become ineffective. They kind of lose their voice with the team, and it's better for them to move on for the current team and for the coach themselves.
Great point,
it's
Lisa.
It's a phenomenon of coaching.
Okay, Jim.
Well, what happened.
Are you loyal to the Celtics or not? Lisa makes a great point. It could be for the good of the team. Could be for the good of the coach.
Well, you know,
for the good
Lisa,
of the Celtics,
if it turns out
it's
good for the team,
go.
Then you know what the Celtics should have done? They should have fired him. If he wasn't doing his job. And he, no, I'm serious.
Didn't you fire Doc Rivers?
Well, why not? If it turns out you're right and he was ineffective, as I have no idea if he was ineffective or not.
You can come to a meeting of the minds. You can say, it's time for you to go on quietly behind closed doors. We'll negotiate your contract buyout. We'll do what it takes.
Marjorie, I don't want to discuss the current events. Lisa, thank you for a fine call.
Lisa, it was a brilliant call, Lisa.
You ever signed a contract, an employment contract?
Yes, I have.
Okay, halfway through, the employer comes up to you and says, hey, Marjorie, I don't know what it is. I just don't feel that comfortable in this relationship. You know, I don't know. I want another columnist. And they say, let's just you move on. Is that okay with you? You say, excuse me, we signed a contract. And then they say, well, wait a second, Marjorie, you said on the radio it was time. I mean, the answer is you make a commitment, you honor it.
But you're forgetting that they negotiated this end. It wasn't like the Celtics are outraged by
I don't know what they are.
Well, they couldn't be that outraged. I mean, they negotiated a deal. They let him out of
this contract. Did Tim Murray negotiate a deal with the people of Massachusetts and get their vote? I would say he did.
You know, once again,
did you agree to let him go?
What did Tim Murray do when he was here as lieutenant governor?
I heard Deval
years.
Patrick say he was one of the most effective number twos in the history of Massachusetts.
When you heard Deval Patrick list those things that he'd done, I would guess it was the first time you'd ever heard the things he'd done when he was lieutenant governor of Massachusetts.
No, as a matter of fact, that's not true. If you read articles constantly, including in your paper, by the way, people said that he was an incredibly effective liaison to the leaders of 351 cities
and towns.
Well,
that's lovely. Did you see any evidence of that concretely?
I don't know.
He was a very effective liaison. Not sure what he was doing in those liaisons.
301-8970. You're lost in the weeds here.
I'm not lost in the
weeds.
There's
a matter of principle. You make a commitment. You honor your commitment.
If both sides that sat down and entered into the contract
agree
that the time is up or it's time to move
on,
or we
agreed.
Understand, people let people out of contracts all the time.
Agreed.
Well, Jim, you don't know either.
Oh, yes, I do. Okay. Let's go to Gary and Webster. I can't disclose my sources, Marjorie.
Okay.
Gary and Webster, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Gary.
Hi. I deeply care. However, I think Doc Rivers is just symptomatic of the entire breakdown of the social contract between the top echelon of our corporations and the people that work for them. For example, my father worked at the Rexnord Corporation for 40 years, loved his job, had a great rapport with the employees, retired with a hell of a pension. There was a great camaraderie between management and workers. Those days are gone.
Can I give you another example, Gary, that doesn't involve your family that Marjorie and I have talked about a lot in the past? There were workers who stayed at Polaroid for one reason and one reason only for their whole careers. They stayed there because the pensions were so spectacular. And then it turns out the pensions disappeared. And do you remember after they sued, the size of the check that one person got was something like $9 or something? So the reality, you're right, it is symptomatic of a total breakdown, a breakdown that bothers me a lot and apparently does not bother some other people in this particular studio. But Gary, thank you for the call.
I don't want anyone to lose their pensions.
But by the way, Gary made a far better point than I did. That is exactly what it is. You make a commitment to your workers to do X, whatever it is, and you dishonor it. It's just a larger scale version of what we're talking about.
As the picture began to change and everybody happily was not dying over their soup the first day of their retirement when they were like 62 years old and when they lived in their 80s and 90s, then things changed. They couldn't afford to do it anymore. And instead of a meeting of the minds and saying, hey, listen, we can't, either you have to retire later or something has to be fixed.
There was a legal commitment that was dishonored. People, these businesses and their legion right now have made commitments, pension commitments, for example, to employees. They dishonor those commitments. They transfer funds to other things inappropriate. It's the exact same thing we're talking about.
Both sides are unreasonable, and they won't come to
a deal. No, you're talking – I know what you're going. You're talking about public sector. You get all upset about the pensions and the public sector. It's a whole different ballgame. The reality is you make a commitment to a set of people or an individual. You have an obligation to honor. And what you're basically saying, Marjorie –
General Motors made a lot.
What?
General Motors made a lot.
And your point is what?
Well, the point is that that's one of the reasons they were going bankrupt.
And who should pay for that?
I think, we're getting far afield here.
No, we're not getting it. It's the exact same point.
Management says we cannot sustain this anymore.
Then you shouldn't have agreed to it.
Then you come back to the union. You say, we want the company to continue. Let's sit down and talk about this. That's what you have to do. And it seems to me, from what I've read, you claim to have these mysterious sources that we don't know about.
I can't disclose what they are.
They're slithering around in the background somewhere.
Yes, they are. Maybe they are. Maybe they aren't.
It says they didn't come to a meeting of the minds.
I don't know what they did, obviously.
Are they slithering or aren't
they? No, can I tell you what I read? And by the way, in your paper and in the Boston Globe, is that when Doc Rivers said, again, from up until this, I thought he was terrific. And I'm sure he is a terrific person. But let me just say this. My understanding is what happened in this case is the reason they, quote, came to a meeting of the minds is because he said, I want out of here. The management of the team said, we don't want somebody coaching the team who's made it clear he doesn't want to be here. How does that work for the players and the public? So when you say they, quote, agreed to let him go, they agreed to let him go because they basically had a knife to their throat.
Maybe, as Lisa from Quincy so brilliantly put it, it was better for the Celtics, in the best interest of the Celtics. He'd been there for a while, done a great job. Maybe the feeling was he wasn't as effective as he was when they won the World Championship. When the World Championship?
3 years ago, maybe.
3 years ago, something like that. And thought it was time for all sides to move on.
Let's take one more principled person, I hope. Stan, you're in Salem, New Hampshire. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Stan.
Good afternoon. I want to say somebody's kind of missing the point.
What would that be, Stan?
This is sports, and it's like team. But I agree with the woman earlier that mentioned that sometimes coaches get burnt out or the teams get burnt out.
Lisa from Quincy. She was a genius.
Yeah, is that the end of the thought there, Stan?
Pretty much, sir.
Well, it was a beautiful thought, and thank you so much for the call. There's a larger point.
What is the larger point, Jim?
The larger point is
we're convincing many people here.
I know. Listen, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's the right position to take.
Okay.
The position I am taking here is this, mm-hmm. is you make a commitment yep. in good faith about anything. You honor the commitment. If the other side in that deal releases you voluntarily, not when you're extorting them out of a deal, then it's fine.
Okay.
But otherwise, you honor your commitment. And you know, I have to say,
if the call comes from NBC,
what?
And Brian Williams has to step aside, and they say, Jim Brody, we've been watching your brilliant interviewing on New England Cable News for all these many years. We have a position here.
Yeah.
We'll even make a studio in Boston. So
I
you can
am
be the
assuming
new
in that situation mm-hmm. before I even had a chance to reflect, NECN would say, for the good of this country, Jim. And for the good of its 350 okay. million inhabitants, we urge you to go.
Okay. Well, we'll see about that, Jim Brody. Okay, up next, it is open mic with the Reverend Eugene Rivers III. We're going to talk a little bit about violence in Boston versus the attention to the Aaron Hernandez case. We're going to talk about lots of stuff. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Gene Rivers up next.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. I guess we're continuing the Doc Rivers theme. Are you not a doctor, Reverend Eugene Rivers III?
Yes, that's true.
Well, there we go. Doc Rivers and Doc Rivers. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you.
Hello, Gene Rivers.
Greetings.
You know, we mentioned when the governor was here last time, he's with us once a month, that you had this big piece in the Boston Herald, and we asked if he'd
Which
seen it.
Which he had
it.
Read, yeah.
Yeah, and he had seen it, and we had asked you if you'd met with the governor. So what's the update on that? Have you met with the governor? Your issues, by the way, were about dads taking better care of their daughters in the city because there's been a lot of shootings lately that have involved young women. So did you meet with the governor?
I spoke to the governor the next day.
Yes.
In fact, I want to thank the governor on the record. I want to thank you for helping facilitate the conversation. Had a great conversation with the governor. We're scheduled to meet to sit down with his public safety people. And if we can, I'd love to meet with Andrea Cabral.
Oh, yes, the former sheriff of Suffolk County. She's now the
Secretary of Public Safety.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
So, I'd like to sit down with her and actually talk about what we do in the city, on the ground. So the governor has been very, very good. We're scheduled to meet and sit down, and so simply booking it. And I've talked to him about the HBO series The Wire, which Jim Brody is the best television show in the history of television.
And when you watch it,
you will be converted, and you will publicly confess.
Now, excuse me. You know, Gene Rivers gave me, as I thought, a present, the complete box set of The Wire. And then he calls me and says, I have to give it back because Governor Patrick needs it. And I thought, can't Governor Patrick, he was a big Coke executive, can't he go out and buy his own box series of The Wire?
So there it is. It's hard for the brother. It's just hard.
It's hard for the brother.
What are you going to ask? So you meet with him, you meet with the governor, and you've been talking about this for a bit. Give us the 30-second version of what you say to him. What are you urging the governor to do?
I'm urging the governor to revisit whatever is the comprehensive strategy they have for getting their arms around violence, because we're talking about a 2-square-mile area. All of this happens in a geographically concentrated area, and we need to begin to focus. I mean, I talked to the mayor's office today. Let's sit down with the community and revisit this thing. In fact, on Thursday, I am working and convening an emergency meeting in the Black community to address what the Black community does, and then we need our partners.
Of whom? Who are you convening? Are there ministers, or what are you doing?
Ministers, public, all the Black elected officials, all the mayoral candidates who want to be mayor of all of Boston, which, I mean, the Black community, right? And sit down and talk about what we do, because it's out of control. 2 points. On Friday, at Shawmut Station, which is in the fancy kind of Melville Avenue area, there were 100 kids virtually rioting at 9:30 at night. They had to call 20 cars. And then there was an instance where some people were at home and the kids broke in while the folk were there. That's out of control. And I'm saying that, obviously, whatever the strategy was, it needs to be amended and fixed because we have some challenges.
Well, one thing that seems to me out of control, I mean, you read about these shootings now. In one case, there was a four-year-old in a car seat in the back of the car, and the shooters came and shot the guy, and he's survived, thank God. But the woman was scrambling to get the baby out of the car. I mean, there seem to be no more rules. And, of course, we had Brianna Bigby the week before that, 23-year-old woman in the car on the right track to, you know, get her life together, and she gets shot just as an innocent bystander in
the car. Ladies and gentlemen, it sounds like terror to me.
Yeah.
It quacks like
the mother,
terror.
The twins, I forgot her.
It wiggles like terror. It sounds like terror. And I want to take this opportunity to ask you both to consider hosting a mayoral forum on public safety with somebody.
We'd love it.
No,
done.
You,
we'd love it.
This is crazy.
You help us organize it, we would love it.
Listen.
Can I say, you mentioned terror a second ago, Gene. You and we and with many other people here, we discussed in the wake of the terror on April 15th, whether or not terror in Roxbury, Mattapan, Dorchester, that sort of thing, was going to get the same sort of attention that obviously was given to in the wake of the marathon. David Bernstein, our colleague here in Boston Magazine, did the math. With the triple murder on Intervale the other day, 70 shootings in 67 days. And I thought Joan Vinaki summed it up great before. It took Aaron Hernandez to finally get the public and authorities to focus on a dead guy from Dorchester. That, of course, is Odin Lloyd, the 27-year-old who
How
was shot. We don't know who did it. Now, but so when you're watching the Hernandez stuff, what are you saying to yourself?
I'm amazed because I resist the temptation to sound strident and say, well, I was talking to someone early this morning. I said, now listen, I understand that Boylston Street was about humans. Humans got killed on Boylston Street.
The marathon.
Right, at the marathon. Those were humans that died. And so we can't tolerate humans getting killed. 77 shootings?
70.
70 shootings. Days. In 60 days, and there's no sense of urgency and outrage, no big vigil. Now, we don't need to invite the president in, right? Now, I understand that, right? But there's no mobilization of public sentiment. We're not going to have a concert to raise $51 million. I'm not sure we'd have a concert to raise $51.
Yeah, but can I tell you something that I find strange about this? And I think, and you know both of them far better than I, in the times that I've spoken to Ed Davis, the police commissioner of Boston, and Tom Menino, the mayor, I think they both really care about this.
Of course they do.
And well, you say, so if of course they do, and Tom Menino is one of the most powerful people, probably powerful mayors in America in terms of his own city.
Unquestionably.
And you believe, and I'm using your words, that Deval Patrick cares about this, you're going to ask him to revisit his commitment. So if three pretty powerful people care about it as deeply as you say, why is virtually nothing that you think should be happening?
Because the Black community has failed. And I have to say this, and my liberal friends have to get with this. You see, part of
why is it just the Black community's responsibility?
I'll tell you why. If we really deconstruct the marathon murder, let me give you a Black translation from the hood, not the bougie Black people, the fancy people we know, the people who live on the earth.
Yep.
You go to a Black barbershop, you talk to guys, and Rivers, let me tell you something. I tell you about that marathon, Rivers. Them white folk wasn't having that. They put the city on lockdown. You hear me? And they found them boys. There was a 100% clearance rate in terms of crime solving when it happened on Boylston Street at the marathon. The clearance rate, I am told, for Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan is 25%.
Okay, so here's my question again. So who cares about what happened on Boylston Street? Who doesn't care about what happens on Intervale or what other place? Who are those people?
Black leadership cares insufficiently. I'm going to press it for this reason. The black elected officials, the black religious leaders have not made noise. And if I'm any politician, frankly, and I sit there and there's no noise, there's no mobilization, there's no outreach that comes from the community. I said this in my Zimmerman piece, right, with George Zimmerman. I said the larger community take their cues from the leadership in this particular community.
Well, hold on. Corporate Boston stepped in right away after the marathon to start that one fund. I think Hancock was the first
The $1 million.
They were humans,
yes.
Y'all.
And then the corporations followed suit.
They were humans.
Yeah, well.
They were humans.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see, I haven't, you don't
they
see.
They were humans.
Mm-hmm.
There was an immediate, effective response. And the thing that I'm actually quite flattered, they said, we will put this city on lock. So we find these dudes. Now, you say to yourself, well,
first of all, we didn't say that. Deval Patrick said that.
Okay,
if you're going to meet with him, you should know that was his decision to make vis-a-vis Watertown and surrounding communities.
Here's the question to the public.
So you're going to ask him to do a lockdown in Roxbury?
No, this is what I'm going to ask. What would be the necessary and sufficient conditions which would have to obtain before the same kind of measures which were taken on in the Boston Marathon case for the black community? How many more black people need to die? How many more black kids need to get shot? How many more girls need to be shot before this becomes the subject of some major foundation forum? There is a major mobilization of the private sector. We actually have a concert, and thanks to Jim Browdy, we were able to desegregate that, so it made sense.
Well, I think...
So that's the question.
I mean, you've heard this, though. You know this Reverend Gene Rivers, and that's whose voice you're hearing is the Reverend Gene Rivers. Tina Cherry, who runs the Lewis D. Brown Priest
Great
Institute,
woman.
She's a fantastic woman. I absolutely adore her. But she's made a point to me several times, and I'm sure many other people have made the same point, that part of the problem is when crimes are reported in the newspaper, not all of them, but a lot of them, there's a line in there that will say, so-and-so, known to police,
sure.
Which basically means this kid has some kind of gang affiliation. And therefore deserve to die, which is not true,
right.
You know, and that's horrible because the kid himself who got shot is maybe 18 or maybe he's 19 or 21. But that's part of it. The idea is that, okay, the people at the marathon were not only white, but they were innocent victims, and there's not enough innocent victims in the inner city of Boston. So what's your rejoinder to that?
My response to that is the following. Even if that's true, it still comes to back to black leadership to speak up. I'll put it this way. I'm impressed that you are willing to talk about the issue of public safety and crime more than just about any black news program I know of in circulation.
Well, because I've been a reporter for a long time in Boston, I guess.
That's a good
Hey, Gene Rivers, did you read the story in the New York Times a week or so ago, the title of which was Chicago Tactics
yes.
Put Major Dent in Killing Trend?
Yes.
For people who didn't see this, a year after the city drew new attention for soaring gun violence and gang bloodshed, creating a political test for Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, former, chief of staff to Barack Obama, killings have dipped to a level not seen since the early 1960s. In recent months, says the New York Times, as many as 400 officers a day working overtime have been dispatched to just 20 small zones deemed the city's most dangerous, tamping down retaliatory shootings, etc. Is the Chicago model one that you'd embrace for... I don't even know what all the details are, but obviously this is working. We were all hearing that this was the killing zone out there. That it was unsafe to be on the streets virtually anywhere. Almost overnight, they've turned this thing around out there.
What I would do first is go to Chicago and drill into it to see what was under the numbers, because the first law of good policing is to make sure you cook your numbers to have them turn out right. So I that's good. If I'm Rahm Emanuel, that's exactly the New York Times story I want in the paper.
The point is, assuming that the cynical side of you is wrong in this case, or at least assuming it's wrong in this case, the point being that there is a way to turn this around almost
yes.
overnight. It's a matter of months.
Yes.
It's not one of these things
yes.
where we have to wait till another generation of young
that's
kids
true.
Are lost and scared out of their minds walking to school. Theoretically, this is something if people actually dedicate themselves, sort of like the marathon and like Chicago, they could have an immediate impact.
Well, see, and the additional point to the Chicago story is that the black community was on Rahm Emanuel hard. and all the analogies about the fact that more Americans got killed on the south side of Chicago than died in Afghanistan. Right?
Yeah.
All right, so the black community was on Rahm Emanuel, and they didn't putz around. Now, I don't want to suggest that the black community need to do that here. I'll simply say this. The black community has failed to force the rest of the city. You know, the corporate mobilization for the humans that died on at the marathon versus 70 shootings. There's something wrong with this. And we, the public, especially in one of the most liberal towns in the United States. So if there's one place where this, so everybody should be viewed as a human, it should be Boston.
Can we switch gears just for a second to something a little more uplifting? I assume people know that Nelson Mandela, who is now 94, is in critical condition in South Africa. I think all of us know, as at least at arm's length as best we can, about the impact he's had in that part of the world. Talk to us a little bit. I think you've met him, have you not? Talk to us a little bit about what impact Mandela has had in this country.
In fact, to talk about Nelson Mandela, you've got to actually talk about the world. Let's talk about the United States. He is an unbelievable figure of just almost peerless stature in the world. In the world. I mean, and I'll just tell the anecdote. I was in Harare, Zimbabwe in 1998, and we were staying at the Harare Sheraton. So we're in the lobby, and I'm putzing around with my kids, you know, just, you know, being nosy. And I saw these police cars pull up, which is sort of funny, right? Lights blaring. Yeah, whoa, what's going on, right? And so I stand there, and all the cops make this line, you know, and shoulder to shoulder. And in comes Nelson Mandela and Robert Mugabe.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
OMG.
The president of Zimbabwe.
The president of Zimbabwe. I said, whoa. So I've got Sojourner, my daughter, with me, right? And a friend. And so they're coming by, and the guards are all there. And I say, Mr. President, President Mandela, would you please shake my daughter's hand? I'm only got to be outrageous enough to actually do that, right? I'm the one stupid enough to do that, right?
And
he stopped. He looked at Sojourner.
Oh, this wow. is great.
He let the two girls come through the guarded, you know, the deal. And he was this, you know, grandfatherly, just irresistibly attractive, tall guy with a smile to die for.
How old were your kids at this point, roughly?
Sojourner must have been maybe 8 or 9. Hmm.
Did she understand the full magnitude?
Well,
did she
actually, know who she was only because she was raised in our house, child.
So, you know, as a guy who knew him, not well, but you met him, you got a chance. How did he get through those 27 years in prison? He was a tough revolutionary, you know.
He was
armed.
A boxer.
Yeah.
No, he,
how did he make it? He got better and better as he went through those years.
This is one of the few stories where the hype is actually true. I mean, no, this is, you know, because 90% of the stuff in the, you know. This is an extraordinary human being, an amazing man. And the thing that actually blows my mind, I remember after he gets out, do either of you remember when Ted Koppel squared off with Nelson Mandela?
Actually, I don't.
No,
there was
either.
This amazing debate on Nightline where Mandela and Ted Koppel thought he could take it to the old man. And at one point in the exchange, Mandela gives this amazing retort that completely stuck Ted Koppel, at which point Mandela says, "Have I stumped you, Mr. Koppel? I'll help you."
I'm guessing the topic is what all of us would like to ask Mandela, which is after suffering like you did for so long and being treated like you did, to come out and say we have to reconcile with those who have oppressed us and worse for decades is not, it's just.
I cannot imagine any other politician in my lifetime that exhibited the grace that he exhibited.
There is that what the Koppel exchange was about, the reconciliation?
Yeah, absolutely. No, okay. At some point, Koppel asked a question about the ANC being a little over the top. And
African National Congress, headed, yes.
Yeah. Couldn't you boys have been a little nicer about this business, right? All right. And so Koppel sort of comes with that. And Mandela sort of looks around. I mean, and it's, you know, I felt for poor Ted Koppel. You know, so Mandela's sitting up looking down at Koppel, right? And with those intense eyes. And it was an amazing experience. And you think about this. Here is a man, having suffered for so long, actually was gracious. He reaches out to Botha and the Afrikaners. I cannot imagine any figure in recent history that exhibited such extraordinary grace. I just can't think. There's no one. I mean, and it's the comportment is, you know, he's majestic.
What impact has he had? We only have a minute or so left. What impact has he had on the United States?
I think that he has impacted an entire generation of people who were, we look up to him as the gold standard.
Yeah.
For grace and dignity and
so
in
Reverend
the face
Rivers, was it because he was praying for 27 years? Is that where it came from?
Well, no, it came from a whole bunch of people praying for him because they pray a lot in South Africa. Thank you very much.
Okay. Reverend Eugene Rivers is with us every
Monday.
What day is it? Monday, y'all.
Thank you. Yeah. Wasn't sure what day it was. Yeah.
By the way, we're up for that debate. I just should just say, if you want to help us pull together,
please.
We are
it
more than happy to convene
for the
a mayoral debate on public safety. We'd love to do it.
Oh, we're not leaving yet. I was mistaken. I had the wrong day, and I'm mistaken. I want to ask you about we were talking about Mandela. I asked you how he survived 27 years in prison. You said other people were praying for him.
Yeah.
I've read these stories about Mandela, about how he also schmoozed not only with his fellow prisoners, but with the guards to get better treatment.
He's
what's
flawless.
What's the best book you think of out there about
there
Mandela?
Is, you know, there's his autobiography with Stride to Freedom.
Yeah,
there
good
are a couple
one.
Of and there's that. There's a guy R.W. Johnson has an amazing book on South Africa that's done right. It's critical of the ANC, and this is a guy that's followed him all his life. He is such an extraordinary figure. And I'll tell you what's interesting. He comes to Harvard. Everybody's about to bow. I mean, what do you do with this? And then his comportment, his style, it's just there's
well,
no other figure.
Remember him dancing on the Esplanade? I mean, he was well into his 70s, I think, then, and
he
really
save a tail for it, though.
Yeah, he was really great and really kind of inspiring. So, what do you think it's going to mean his passing?
The thing that I've been thinking about as we're winding down is that we don't have any figure in the world that can bring the gravitas, has the moral authority and stature of a Mandela.
Yeah, the reason he has moral authority, at least in my judgment, the final word for me, I want to repeat it again, I cannot imagine, as someone who even the smallest slight, and I have a feeling you're sort of the same way, Gene Rivers,
yes,
even though you're
a
man of the cloth, it has to be returned in kind eventually. The fact that he's willing to either forget... Well, you're kinder than that, Marjorie. Everybody knows
you,
that.
No, you're actually more civilized. Yeah, you're actually a much more civilized
in any
than
case.
He is. Doesn't take much.
By the way, we should say our thoughts and everything else are with President Mandela. He is in critical condition.
Family,
we should be clear. He has not died, but they say he's in pretty bad shape, and we're all thinking about him. Gene Rivers, it's a pleasure to see you, as always.
Thank you.
We'll see you again next Monday.
We're going to work on this debate. We're going to get this mayoral forum.
And I am back on planet Earth now. It is Monday, so I'm apprised of that.
Now, as everybody knows, Gene, thank you so much. It's good to see
you.
As everybody knows, tomorrow, I hope you all know, despite what the Secretary of State said, I know we're distracted by the Bruins, the Whitey Bulger trial, this Hernandez hysteria. There is an election tomorrow, a really important election. We have invited both candidates to join us just for a minute or two on their final campaigning day. We invited Ed Markey. We invited Gabriel Gomez. Joining us on the phone is the congressman who's the Democratic nominee. We really appreciate a couple of minutes of your time. Ed Markey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
So, Congressman Markey, I think I've read that you're going to 227 towns today, tomorrow, and So you're like going all across the state, right?
Yeah, we're crisscrossing the state, and each day, yesterday I started in Malden to Lynn to Lowell to Waltham to Framingham to Worcester to Springfield, and all you do is just stay on the road, you crisscross the state, trying to pump up the vote. In the final 4 days, our team will call or ring the doorbells of 3 million people from last Friday until election night. And I love this. This is the fun part of politics, being out there and meeting with people, and the response has been great.
Hey, Ed Markey, do you get nervous? These are major stakes. This is not some... I was a city councilor in Cambridge, and I was nervous. Are you nervous 19 hours before the polls open?
Yeah, the only way to deal with that, Jim, is just to work. You're out there, and the more you meet with the people who are helping you, is the more you just focus on election day. Because if you just sat back and did nothing, then you'd have too much time on your hands. So the best way of dealing with it, especially over the final week, is just to go out all day, every single day, because in every single city and town, there's at least 100 people waiting for me, and some it's 200 people, and it's every place. So I feel very good about it. And then, it gives you the adrenaline, and then, you know, I feed off the volunteers, and it just makes it a more exciting, pleasurable final 5 or 6 days.
Now, Congressman, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, even though you're doing very well in the polls, up double digits in most of them. There are many, many congresspeople. There are not that many senators. Have you checked out the prospective office that you might wind up getting should you prevail in the election tomorrow? I bet it's bigger than the one you're in already, isn't it?
Marjorie, here's the way I'm thinking about it.
What?
I'm thinking the same way the Bruins are. The Bruins are not trying to figure where they're putting the Stanley Cup yet, you know, and I'm not trying to figure where I'm going to be doing anything on the Senate side. You have to first win it, and that's really the only focus that I can have and the only focus the Bruins can have.
Hey, and when you think of your office, I was about to say goodbye, Ed Markey. Before I say goodbye, tell people who don't remember the legendary ad that was done for your friend of mine, Dan Payne, a while ago when you first ran for Congress. Can you describe the ad for us?
We had a system of judges in Massachusetts. It allowed for the judge, they were called special judges, now you'll know why, they could actually keep their law clients as well. So they were both a judge and a lawyer at the same time with clients. So that went back to colonial times. It was 200 years old. There were 80 of them in the state. My bill abolished the system. It gave them all 3 years to decide. All judge, all lawyer, you can't have both. Well, it ticked off a lot of people. The Speaker of the House kicked me off the Judiciary Committee on the day in which I was being honored as Legislator of the Year by the Massachusetts Bar Association.
Oh, God.
Which was a bad coincidence. And then my predecessor and then kicked my desk out in the hall, actually threw me off the Judiciary Committee and threw my desk out of the Judiciary Committee. And so my predecessor in Congress, Talbot McDonald, he passed away. There was an election for Congress. I ran. And the TV commercial, as you mentioned, with Dan Payne, the final line was with me standing in front of my desk outside of the chamber in the House was, "The bosses can tell me where to sit. Nobody tells me where to stand."
Pretty clever. Hey, Ed Markey, thanks for the call. Good luck tomorrow. We really appreciate your time, Congressman.
Thank you, Montre. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much.
By the way, we should mention that Gabriel Gomez, we did extend an invitation. We were told by his staff he's at an event in Brockton and cannot join us before 2 o'clock. By the way, Gabriel Gomez will be on with me for, I believe, his final pre-election interview tonight at 6 on NECN. Hope you'll tune in.
Okay, it is hot outside. It is summertime outside. It is tourist time in Boston. The weather might be agreeable, but what about access to public restrooms when it comes to commodes? Is the city of Boston accommodating? That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's hot, and there are two great problems you all face in the summer. One is how to deal with the heat, and we gave you advice on that several weeks ago, including Marjorie's legendary wet sheet strategy.
Legendary.
The other problem, and this is a big one, it's a huge one, how to find a bathroom. And that's our topic briefly now. You're out and about in the city, any city, but Boston in particular, nature calls and no one answers. And we want to know, what is your strategy? This is a real topic at 877-301-8970. If you don't think it's real, then you didn't read the great piece in the Globe the other day called Restroom Scarce on the Freedom Trail.
Yeah,
what do we learn?
Here's the image. You have 100 people getting off a bus, maybe 150 people.
This is horrible.
Maybe they're elderly people. Maybe they're people who are visiting the bathroom a little bit more than possible than they used to. And they're going around the Freedom Trail, and there is not a bathroom anywhere on site. They've got this poor guy, the vicar of the Old North Church, who's made two restrooms available for those trekking along the Freedom Trail because there are none. So he has the two restrooms available. He asked for a buck donation so he can keep up with the toilet paper and washing out the bathroom and stuff like that. People are begging at these cafes in the North End. It's unbelievable to have people come here. That's one of our big tourist sites, right?
Well, excuse me.
Say, come here, see the Freedom Trail, but don't go to the bathroom for the whole time you're on it.
877-301-8970. You're in downtown Boston. Nature calls, as I say. What do you do? By the way, North End is bad. Downtown Crossing is not much better. When you go to a hotel, I can tell you this firsthand. You go to a hotel because the hotel is nearby. Don't assume you can just walk into the men's room. What'll happen is if you go into a hotel lobby, more often than not, what someone will say to you politely is, "Sir, can I help you?" And what are you going to say? I need to find a urinal? I mean, you really can't do that. You know, I have a strategy. I'm going to share it with people right
away.
Walk into a hotel. Mm-hmm. This is true. I do it all the time. You look at your watch as if you're, and you look around like you're looking for somebody. And then you walk up to someone in authority and say, have you seen a man here? He's about 6'2". He'll be wearing a gray suit with a whatever. And when they know you're looking for somebody, at least they see it. Then you look at your watch again. You say, well I'm going to use the bed. And you go use the men's room. But if people think that it's as simple as just finding one and going there, they're fooling themselves. 877-301-8970. Tell the story from the North End restaurant about what the priorities are for some. I think it's a woman who talks about who she allows to use the public restroom and who she doesn't.
She has kind of a triage system.
You
have to be a little kid, or you have to be a pregnant woman, or you have to be old. Because dozens and dozens of people come using the bathroom. You know what the other place is? It's just so egregious.
What's that?
The public garden, the swan boats, and the little make-way for duckling statues. So who do you go with, for the most part, to the little make-way for duckling statues?
Little kids.
So you've got two little kids with you, three little kids with you. Then you go to look at the little ducklings, and they're wonderful little statues. Then you go take a ride in the swan boats. Before you know it, you've been there for an hour and a half, not to mention coming down the tee. No bathrooms for you and your little kids either. 877-301-8970. I mean, this is somewhat of an embarrassment. You know, we had this system for a while. We're going to have more public restrooms around town.
Yeah, for $250,000.
Has not worked out that
well. You know what the deal with it? People have gotten locked in some of those. I don't know if it's happened in Boston. There's a little story, I don't know where it's from, some little kid. You know, when the door closes, the walls and the floor start exploding water and cleansing agents.
Yeah,
a kid got trapped in there and almost drowned.
Well, you know what I love? They give you like a warning. Apparently, there's a bell that comes in. You only get 15 minutes in some of these bathrooms, which seems a sufficient amount of time, unless it's an emergency situation. Then they give you the bell, the three-minute warning, and you better get the hell out of there because they are going to lock the doors, and you're going to be sprayed by all this water, and they're going to have these like robotic scrubbers come out and clean the toilet seat.
We'll get to your calls in 1 second. Here are a couple of very sane Facebook postings from our listeners at the Boston Public Radio Facebook page. Here's Diane. I totally agree with this. If you cater to and benefit from tourists and tourism, then you have a duty to provide basic necessities, open the purse strings, and buy some new restrooms. Boston, I agree. And Ahoy says, and this is the alternative approach I would not suggest, but it is real, you can always find a bush. 877-301-8970. Share your strategies. Be generous today. Share your strategies for finding a place when you need one. Let's start in Norwell with Rosemary on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie, hey there. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
The strategy I was sharing was just one my husband employs, and that is to find a church, because church usually has a bathroom towards the back, and it's usually a clean bathroom. So just keep that in mind.
That's what they and the story talks about this guy at the Old North Church.
Reverend Stephen Ayers.
Yes, that he has like hundreds of people coming to use the bathrooms there, and it becomes a real problem because there's no place else to go. You know, the poor guy is going to charge people a buck so he can keep up the toilet paper expenses.
Hey, Rosemary, thanks for the call. You know, this is a serious subject. You know what they do in Cambridge? If you're in Central Square, there's signs that are pretty prominent that say public restrooms and there are quite a few actually, in the basement of City Hall. And they're really, this woman, Diane, who wrote, are both having coughing fits here. It's totally true. You have an obligation. If you invite people in your city, and not just tourists, but people who don't have an apartment or a condo or something in downtown, they got to be attended to.
They interviewed this lawyer, this Thomas Schiavone guy, who lives just a couple of doors down from the Cobb Hill Burying Ground, and he talked about how families are banging on the door, desperate to come in and use the first floor bathroom. So here's this house. So here's this nice guy opening the door to strangers, and sometimes when they just can't keep up with the demands on their front door, people do use, dark recesses inside parking garages or stone walls.
Well, you know, a couple of minutes ago, if you just tuned in, Congressman Ed Markey, the Democratic nominee for United States Senate, called, and he said there have been 3 million people whose doors have been knocked on the last couple of days. That's why people are knocking on the doors, because it's an emergency situation.
Did you read the letter to the editor about this?
I did. This is a great letter.
Tom Menino is known as the urban mechanic, and this guy, Robert Skoll from the North End, wrote into the Globe and said, with luck, his successor will be what we really need around here, an urban plumber.
By the way, every single person listening to the show has confronted this situation. This is not an aberrational thing. Everybody has had this problem. And it's, you know, by the way, if one of these, how many candidates? There are a dozen running for mayor. If part of a platform, and I don't mean this as a joke at all,
bathroom platform?
Was a, well, I'm not saying the centerpiece of their mayoral candidacy, but if a major part of their theme was to say, we're going to accommodate people, that would be a big deal.
Let's go to Paul from West Roxbury. What do you think, Paul?
Hey, I wanted to know if you guys happen to remember. I just remembered that for a few years, the mayor had these special state-of-the-art self-cleaning lavatories, restrooms set up in various parts of downtown. There was one right behind City Hall, across from Faneuil Hall.
Paul, that's what we're talking about. They cost $250,000 a piece. And Chelsea checked, our colleague checked before, and we believe there is one on Commercial Street that is still active. We have no idea what the state of the rest is. But apparently, that's at the Boston Public Library, there is one. But apparently, the promises were not met.
What do you mean, promises?
Meaning the promise to
the
have
toilets.
A ton of these things so that we'd have them throughout the city.
Right,
I think you paid a quarter or something.
They were $250,000.
Yeah, but I mean,
and
you paid. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, they could be supported by, I think that was the thought, they'd be supported in part by advertising, the cost of constructing them, as some of the bus shelters are these days. It is an embarrassment. I'm glad you're raising the topic. We are supposedly, as the mayor likes to say, a world-class city.
Yeah.
But we're unable to meet people's basic needs. It's
beautifully
crazy.
Put, Paul. Thank you for the call.
Well, you know, it's one of the ironies here. There was a public restroom in the middle of the, is it in the public? It wasn't in the public garden. It was across the street in Boston Common. And now, of course, as we know, the Pink Palace, as it was called, has been turned into the
Earl of Sandwich
shop. You say to yourself,
that was years ago.
What do we need more in Boston? Do we need more Pink Palaces or do we need more sandwich shops? I think the answer is clear. And who wants to go buy a sandwich in a place that was a public restroom for 50 years?
Well, some people do, Marty. It was a long time ago. And
really?
I'm sure
have you been there, Jim?
I've walked by it.
Exactly. You may walk by it. You're not stopping in there. Let's go to Christine from Connecticut. Hi, Christine.
Hi. My family was having a big birthday celebration at the Intercontinental down at the seaport.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in there, and all of a sudden we see these hikers with backpacks taller than I was on their backs, women and men. And they had their smartphones out, their cell phones, and they were finding the bathroom there. They were using the bathrooms there, and I felt sorry for the guards because they didn't know what to do. But it really ruined the celebration for us because we drove an hour and a half to go up to Boston and then to spend it with these. They were pretty dirty, the hikers, to see that. And
thought, were they washing?
But you have to be, Christine, you have to be a little more charitable. I mean, put yourself in the place. I'm not exactly a hiker type or a backpacker, but put yourself in the place of, as you call them, the dirty backpackers. What are they supposed to do?
Well, I don't know. I don't know, but they ruined my celebration.
Well, you're an honest woman, Christine. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to see people in there washing in the sink when you're in there.
No,
in
I don't
fancy
like that either.
Outfit,
no.
Jim, you know what I'm saying? It kind of ruins the whole the ambiance, as we say.
Maybe
correct?
It does.
Therese from Hudson. What do you think, Therese?
I know I have a special case because I have to go to the bathroom about every hour because I have a bladder illness.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I don't even go into Boston. I have a daughter. I'd love to take her, make way for ducklings, whatever, but I can't. I mean, I just can't.
Well, you were
isn't that ridiculous? I mean, they talked about in London how they have these, especially for people getting out of closings at the bars late at night. They have a lot of problems, people just going on the street. So they have these toilets that rise up out of the ground.
They do?
Yes. Did you read that story about London? It's great. And then they sink back down during the day so they're not like all over the streets. But we need something like that in Boston.
The problem was a lot of the people in London got caught in them when they went back into
the
ground.
That was one of the problems.
That
there was some poor guy that was in there all night long.
Therese, that's a very sad story. And we hope, actually, next time we talk to a mayoral candidate, we'll pass along your travails.
Thank you. The one positive I will say is I'm so grateful now that you can go to bookstores and grocery stores, and you know that wasn't true in the 80s.
That is an excellent point, by the way. That is an excellent point. Most grocery stores, and it's true, bookstores, I'm glad you brought that up, are another decent location. Thanks for the call. Hotels are not kind.
Yeah.
Restaurants often say, unless you're a customer at this place, we're not doing that thing either.
Yeah, you have to spend a lot of time in bookstores when you're taking little kids around. That's all I can say, Jim. You're kind of stranded there all day long in the city of Boston because there's no place else to go. Do we have time for one more
call? We do. Take it.
Abby from Westboro. What do you think, Abby?
There's an app for your iPhone, and I've used it on an iPad called Sit or Squat. And it's under the travel in apps. And it's actually subsidized, I think, by Charmin. But it gives you, wherever you are in whatever location, it tells you what bathroom is free, and it rates how good they are, how bad they are, and where they are.
That is great. Is it sit and squat or sit or squat?
It's sit or squat.
Yeah, you have
That's
to,
great.
You have to choose.
It's mostly under the iPhone app, but it can be downloaded to an iPad.
Hey, Abby, we're really appreciative of you making that call. And by the way, if you do a little Google search, and we should have done that before the show, there are a number of not just apps, there are websites too, that do a rating, tell you, and also tell you strategies. We should have said this, strategies on how to gain access when the proprietor of the particular place is not dying to give it to you.
Yeah, well, it's always a 50-50 thing. The point is there should be more bathrooms.
There really should
accessible
be.
To people when you're downtown Boston, the big tourist spots. I
biggest
think
issue in the mayoral race in Boston.
Huge,
let's face
huge.
It. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. If you tune in tomorrow, Dan Kennedy's Muzzle Awards, his awards for those who have hindered our freedom of speech. And you can follow us on Twitter at BOS Public Radio, me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. We thank Congressman Markey for joining us. And as I mentioned, at 6 o'clock tonight, Gabriel Gomez's final pre-election interview with me. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.